This is Mario Jacoby, and this is September 27th, 1991, Fig Leaves of Adam and Eve.
100 years before, or is it all right now? Okay. It's interesting that Aristotle, 400 years before Christ, saw already this important distinction between these two tendencies of our shame, our sense of shame. And he called it the sense of shame regarding things that are offensive in the eyes of public opinion. And that is in contrast to a sense of shame regarding things that are offensive in the eyes of pure truth. They are opposites. There's a tribe in New Guinea, we know they make the difference between skin shame and deep shame. If a person is observed while urinating or engaging in sexual intercourse, he feels skin shame. But if that person offends the spirits of his ancestors, he reacts with deep shame. In its first form, shame is thus an emotional reaction to the fact that one has not complied with the expected norms of society. In its second form, shame occurs when an inner value system that is linked to the ego ideal, to the self, what we say, is violated. And such opposition within the total functioning of shame can therefore lead to shame conflicts. For example, I am ashamed to express my dissenting opinion, which the others may not agree with, because I'm afraid of being rejected, of not being taken seriously, being ridiculed. That would be a shame according to public opinion. But as soon as I get home, I could tear my hair out. So great is my shame I feel over my cowardice, over my incapacity to stand up for myself and my opinion. I feel a loss of self-esteem because I did not plead for my inner truth, perhaps even denied it, because I didn't want to feel ashamed to have another opinion, be rejected. Such shame conflicts are very frequent, and they underlie, among other things, what is called a lack of civil courage. Thus, shame is on one hand the advocate of society's unwritten code, very often unwritten code, because the written code has more to do with guilt. And that code has partly been internalized by the individual, yet it is also the ally of our inner authenticity and our deepest conviction. Therefore, it plays a great part in the process of individuation. I think that without this feeling of shame, and of if we are not true to ourselves, we could, individuation would not be possible. And one of the most moving passages in the New Testament narrates a shame conflict of this kind. I'm thinking of Peter, who before the cock crows denies 3 times that he is a disciple of Jesus, so as not to feel ashamed of his discipleship in front of the bystanders. And then, when he remembers the words of Jesus, he goes away and weeps bitterly, out of shame for his cowardice, which Jesus had prophesied already. I believe that there is hardly anything more moving than Johann Sebastian Bach, if you know that setting of this passage in the Passion of St. Matthew or St. John, maybe this music. Through this music, we are brought really to share in the tears of Peter's bitter remorse and shame. It's very difficult not to cry over this if you hear this. No? Its most prominent role, I think, shame plays in the realm of interpersonal relationships. It is as if shame erects an invisible barrier between me and the environment, between I and thou. It acts like a finely tuned barometer that notifies my feelings of the degree to which I'm able and willing to open myself to another person. And here we come to the far-reaching matter of trust. I must trust that the other person will respect my dignity or my integrity if I let him or her approach more nearly to my naked truth, as it were. Fear that giving voice to my inner life will mean self-surrender is surely connected with the fear of being unmasked by others as a result of personal confessions, of showing too much of myself, of exposing myself too much. It's also connected with the fear of being belittled and humiliated, not being taken for serious. In any case, an extended period of getting acquainted is usually required to develop a feeling for the distance I must keep between myself and someone else, or how close to me I can let the person come. This is a process of weighing and judging, in which shame may be of great help in establishing boundaries not to be overstepped. Shame does not appear, it only appears if it's overstepped. But there is a certain sense, a feeling of not to overstep it in order not to fall into this shame barrier. This shame barrier. And I, as an analyst, it's very interesting that in the field, in the interactive field between the analyzer, the client, and me, well, very often I can sense it. I sometimes can even see where they are surrounded by this shame threshold and where one has to be very careful to touch it, not to touch again, touch it and so forth. And it can vary to a great extent, of course, growing trust, it can be less sick and food. Feelings of shame so often arise when I'm tormented by the thought that I've given too much of myself away in a situation with someone who does not deserve my trust, whether that is now realistic or not. And trust is something that is highly complex and easily disturbed. I must determine with whom and in what situations I can let go of some of my persona coverings, whether I can do without their protection of my personality. And the answer is to this question depends on my estimation of how much I can trust, especially in the many situations where rivalry and competition play so prominent a part, where there are winners and losers. It seems dangerous to show my weak points. It's nice on this. You will have also some dance music on the on the tape. That's a good background for the shame theme, no? Is it then possible for me to develop the differentiation, a kind of a feeling for the person I can trust and the person I cannot trust? Because that is really, you never can say, where do I have to feel ashamed of, or how can I develop this feeling? And this capacity to trust as well as to mistrust, of course, on a realistic basis, usually has a childhood history. And the childhood history exerts a decisive influence on the formation of this capacity and can lead to neurotic distortions. And too many early experiences of humiliation often lay the foundations of a thick bulwark of mistrust. The horrible feelings of humiliation and disgrace that one was forced to endure as a child, and most children have to endure something of this, one really prefers not to relive as an adult. Instead, the adult is forced to experience an enormous mistrust toward every person who comes near and fears that in the other wishes only to triumph over oneself, and so forth. Even in the analysis, it often takes years until a somewhat supportive basis of trust can be established, because many persons have developed a persona, a fig leaf, which sends out the message, stay away. And if this message gets across, other people make only feeble attempts or none at all to approach. And this in turn becomes a sign that one is unloved and rejected. And as an unloved and lonely person, one feels again devalued and in the eyes, and again, so it's a whole kind of vicious circle. But even the analyst in analysis is sometimes very, very a long work until some trust can be established. Not infrequently, the analyst is experienced as a cruel, overpowering intruder before whom the analysand is bound to feel unspeakably ashamed as soon as he wishes to share his true feelings. That happens very often, not in the hour, but between hours. Then people have spent terrible few days to think what they have now shared, and how terrible, what I must think, what the analyst now thinks of them. And there are terrible days and nights and dreams and so forth, and it's important that they come back with it, and you feel it and work it over, where this lack of trust is, and something so human they shared and is so valuable and so forth. They have always to be confirmed again and again that it is valued. And the inner world of such person is ruled very often by an inhuman dictatorship, a condition that is sometimes expressed in dreams of being in a concentration camp, of getting humiliated, of tortured, of sentenced to death. And it reminds me very much of Erich Neumann, who wrote in connection with the disturbed primary relationship. I quote Neumann because it's very beautiful what he says. He says, the great mother of primary relationship, as a goddess of fate, decides over life and death by her favor or disfavor. And at the same time, her attitude is a decree, a sentence passed by a Supreme Court. That, practically speaking, that means for a client, patient with this kind of wound, I'm guilty to be alive at all, because life, as a great mother, has said no to me. And it is true, one can find a lot of primary guilt in patients with a high degree of early damage, as we say today, the disturbed primary relationship. But I feel that this no, the no comes from the great mother, comes from life, is a feeling of being unloved and unwanted. And that brings, I think, much more forth not guilt, it brings forth primary shame. That means I should not be seen on this earth. I should think, nobody should see me. I'm not worthy to be part of humanity. Something is fundamentally wrong in me because I'm basically unlovable. And I think the feeling of being unlovable is really the deepest basis of shame. And therefore, rejection and so forth has such deep wounds, hurts so terrible. And that is the ultimate rejection, and nothing what I am is worth anything. We can infer from that an excessive tendency to react with shame is connected with figures in our inner world who viciously humiliate our sense of self at the smallest provocation. The existence of such negative inner figures, who are usually linked with figures from childhood, makes it very difficult for the person concerned to accept himself as he really is. And that is at the basic, you cannot accept yourself. You feel so much shame about yourself, you hate yourself so much, and so forth. It's so difficult to find joy and contentment with oneself in one's particular individuality. The devaluing inner figures will be all too easily then reinforced by the slightest remarks, by the slightest outer devaluing or critical remarks. Thus, shame comes up whenever the person feels devalued or not accepted, which invariably means that he cannot accept himself. And that, of course, so many people are touchy, vulnerable, and they think they're all, and so forth, but it has not just to do with what someone said outside, offense, but it is kind of that a certain remark gets the inner process, the inner devaluing going. If we wish to inquire into the nature of the ego ideal, because we have then a high ego ideal, how we would be without shame, in most cases we will encounter the influence of so-called grandiose self and more or less pronounced perfectionism takes over. And this means that what I am and what I can do and what I achieve and is never good enough. And if I'm seen in any of my deficiencies, I'm soon invaded by shame, because then I'm nobody anymore. So I must be perfect in at least one area. And my striving for perfection assumes a high level of intensity to encounter shame, but is liable to be blocked by the slightest disappointment. I then fall into a deep abyss from discouragement and loss of self-esteem, and again feel ashamed of my grandiosity in pretending to be capable of ever attaining anything perfect. Just will be another 5 minutes, I think, and then we make a break and for discussion. I think I finish now this. Now, quite generally, it should be said that striving for a certain perfection belongs somewhere to the process of self-realization and individuation, because we want to achieve something better, we want to improve the world, to improve ourselves, and so forth. It really belongs to it. Yet Jung has something very crucial, I think, to say in this regard, though, by insisting on the distinction between perfection and completeness or wholeness. And he writes in Ion that whoever aspires to perfection must suffer from the opposite of his intentions for the sake of completeness. He says that in connection to the cross, when he talks about Christ crucified on the cross, that it was in German, was say durchkreuzen. You know, there's a striving for perfection, and there comes something durchkreuzen means it's just the. It crosses it through. I don't know if there's an English word for this. It doesn't cross out, it crosses through. So it's really, he has to suffer then the opposite for the sake of completeness. In other words, perfection excludes what is shadowed and disturbing, whereas wholeness does not. There is considerable tension between my drive toward perfection on one hand and my acceptance of my being as it is, with its particular shadow and its various flaws. I think we live really from this tension. This tension is needed because unqualified self-satisfaction produces a tensionless, undynamic state, a soulless boredom. In the latter context, and feelings of shame and inferiority or guilt can certainly be signals sent by the deeper self, by the pure truth in Aristotle's sense, indicating that the process of life and individuation is blocked and too self-satisfied. For there For there's something that wishes to be realized in life. On the other hand, only the acceptance of my limitations can reduce overgrown shame, guilt feelings to their normal guardian functions, so to speak. I would call them shame, in a way, a guardian function. Because there's a basic task of shame is to guard our human dignity, and the basic task of guilt is to guard our ethical conduct. So I would say in conclusion that let us remember that the art of living consists in perpetually resolving this very tension, namely the tension between the drive toward achieving something, towards perfection, and the fundamental affirmation of our personal human limitations in ourselves, in our partner. If you only say, "Oh, you have to accept your partner as he, she is," you have to accept ourselves as we are. If you just only accept, there are things we cannot accept. No, but if we always try, no, they cannot be accepted. All the time, it has to be changed and improved, and perfectionism and so forth, and all that will be better, and so forth. Then it's one side on the other level. So this tension, I think, is really we cannot resolve this tension. We only can bring it again and again to a tolerable balance, I would say, what analysis maybe tries to achieve or what we try to achieve in life. And in this endeavor, I think shame plays its very meaningful part. So I think we can all make a pause. When I was talking, I think the basic, the really deepest basic is a feeling of being unlovable. And that has, of course, to do with very early childhood experiences. And in connection to the paradise myth, it is interesting that, of course, that is, if we think of it, we can think of it in many, many ways, but let's say we think of it in developmental psychology. And there is a phase about between 15 and 18 months in the infant when the infant begins to recognize himself in the mirror. He begins to speak, and he or she begins also to have a feeling that it can be seen at, when it walks round and so forth, at the beginning of feeling I can be seen at what was before not, and there is reflection. That is the beginning of reflection, and I'm in, and this, and we know, for instance, that then children talk about themselves in the third person. Johnny is bad, or Johnny should be thrown away, should be rejected. If he is bad, he's thrown into a corner and so forth. That is, in a way, the beginning of how we treat ourselves as we have been treated in childhood, because we see that the children do that about the symbol of the images of themselves. And if that image, the self image which begins there, is rejected and not loved and not valued, not in connection to what the child expresses and that is not seen enough, or if it's just a kind of the fantasies of the parents, it is love just because it's musical or because it's beautiful or because a certain fantasy about it, but not how the child really is, then something basically feels unloved and unrecognized. And if we talk of recognize, it has to do with to get known and to know myself, and otherwise it doesn't exist, and it is shameful. And that is before even it is expressed, shame on you, try to control you, so forth. Of course, there's this mixture of how the being as it is, being how I am, is accepted. And of course, the socialization, and in different cultures, and we just have been talking in the interval between, I come from a puritanical, Calvinistic culture in Geneva and in Switzerland, someone else talked about the culture in Scandinavia, where you never show really your faith. You control yourself is the most important thing. Otherwise, shame on you if you are spontaneous and so forth. So the deepest feeling is I am rejected. I am not all right the way I am on this earth. And then the education, do this and do not that. I mean, all this comes together in how shame comes about, and the shame, which is because shame in itself, as I said, is something very valuable and very, very important, but the kind of pathological shame, or too much shame and inhibiting shame. Yes, I don't know whether I answered what you yes. Yes, by which mechanism the grandiose self and perfectionism enters this picture was a question. Of course, this so-called grandiose self is a theoretical. I don't know if is it a theoretical construct. Kohut, in his Psychology of Narcissism, Self-Psychology, talks about it, and Kernberg talks about it in connection to narcissistic personalities. And Kohut is of the opinion that there is a kind of early, before the boundaries are there, there is a feeling of omnipotence, of omniscience, of awe, of paradisical unity, and only slowly the child gets through optimal frustration, as we say, to take reality and kind of ambitions which are more realistic. Kernberg is more of the opinion that it is in compensation of too much fears, of too much dependence and so forth, too much inferiority, and so forth. So it's a mechanism in early childhood. I'm not so sure anymore about Kohut with the modern infant research. I'm not so sure anymore to what extent Kohut is right. So I feel it probably has a lot to do with the question of, in order not to fall into this shame states, to overcompensate, like Adler has already talked about this, in a kind of not feeling vulnerable by, no, I can do it all, with the grandiosity of, but grandiosity and depression belong, of course, together. Alice Miller is writing in her best first book a lot about this grandiose and the depressive, and how they belong together and in connection to the early mothering. And so it is something, it has this perfection and this grandiosity has a lot to do with I don't know the boundaries yet. Or I is something unlimited, because to be perfect and to be grandiose and so forth is an unhuman way of being, or to project the ideal and the grandiosity on parents or on... yet, at the same time, it is, of course, our whole being has to do with limitations and wanting to overcome limitations. And so it probably, I feel, it is something archetypal, also this grandiosity, because wanting to overcome and wanting to improve and wanting to not to stay in those limits we have. And I think it begins already with the loin, with the symbolism of the loin cloth. We don't stay naked. We can do something about it, and we can do more about it, and we can change nature. That's particularly human that we can change nature, and maybe it would have been better if you think today, if in the Middle Ages or in the Renaissance, one would have listened to the church who said, no, you should not investigate nature because it's a sin against God. We would not have our technology, but also we would not have the possibility to destroy the world. And with all this being able to change nature, and nature today tries to revenge herself for all this change we do to her, and so forth. But there are always these two sides to it. Yes? Yes? Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. It is, I talk tomorrow, we'll go into this subject more in detail about that it come, on one hand, it has to do with the image, but it is somewhere also very much earlier in the sense of how is the relation and the feeling of being accepted or rejected is really something much earlier. But then it gets decoded, it gets a kind of a code, it gets an image, how I can love myself, that means how I'm loved. And our whole being as a individuation process or what we try, of course, to do by analysis, by development, is, of course, that we are not so much prey to what has been done to us, but more trying that the self can arise and we can deal much more with what has been done to us. Yes? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. 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 You see, if you talk of the archetype of the old wise man, of mother archetype, and they are all images. Jung talked about the archetypes very much in images, and because he thought they are primary images. And he said, but there is a lot of affect and luminosity and emotion and so forth connected with those images. Now, at the same time, he also talked about, there is an infrared end where the archetype goes into in a kind of biology in a kind of instinctive nature, and the other is the spiritual one, and where it goes, the imagery. Now, I'm interested to develop or to differentiate more that part which has to do with feeling, with affect, with... I think now that is very much done. Verena Kast did it with joy. She talked about joy, and I do it now with shame and so forth. And there are not so much images, there are archetypal affects, archetypal feelings, which are seen from a different point of view. Of course, that is there unconsciously, shame. It only comes about when a certain consciousness is too much said, but a certain awareness of it, because people, children feel so much ashamed when they are in way. You cannot talk about the 18 or 19 month old infant that it is conscious in that sense. It's a certain awareness which goes with it. So if you talk of the mother, let's say you talk of the mother archetype, and then you talk about that it's a need on one hand for the baby experiences mother archetype, and that is a need to be held, the need to be fed, the need to be loved, and so forth. Now, if this need of the mother archetype, of the good mother, is not responded to, then the image of the mother and the mother archetype, there is a terrible mother who swallows, who dismembers, and all these things. Now, what feelings go now together with those images? And I think shame is one very important feeling which goes together with this archetypal image of the mother, of the needs were there to be mothered, and it is not fulfilled, and it is said no to me. What Neumann says is, you know, Neumann talks about this, a great mother says no. And that, what does it mean? That means he thought it's primary guilt then. And I mean it is primary shame. I'm unloved. I'm not accepted in this world. But it's not necessarily an image that I'm not accepted. It's a feeling. So it's an archetypal... I'm glad about this question, because it makes me think, if I talk about shame as archetypal, but what about the images? Or is it now something different when I talk about shame as archetype? And anything which is collectively human is archetypal, and so it's not just the images. I don't know whether it makes the always too complicated. Yes. Yeah, we don't have to be ashamed that we are tired. No? Huh? Oh, there's still a question. I thought what I want to talk tomorrow, but we can see what we to discuss, that I want to go in more to the early development of shame states, together with what that means in the relationships, in our their relationships. Then I thought something very important is the so-called inferiority complex, because that is really the essence of shame state, because shame has so much to do with self sense of self-esteem. An inferiority complex as an archetypal layer of self is felt as negative. Self is felt as self-hatred and so forth. And what I also want to do in more or less detail, to go into an analytic in analytic situations of shame states, where it really comes into the interactive field, where the analyst feels in the counter-transference and so forth, also to talk more on therapy of shame states. That is, and I heard there will be also mainly therapists who, or also people interested in therapy or so, who will come. Yeah. Yes.
Have you explored the any of the famous mythology, or is there any such a thing as the famous
Nemesis? What do we see me? Yes, he is a nemesis. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, because Themis is really the goddess of mores, the collective code. And the Greeks thought that the collective code, or the collective code of behavior, and the collective code is something which stems from a goddess, and it is true. It in itself, but it always can, of course, have. Otherwise, it would not arise. But collective morals and so forth are really, in a way, always originate from the self, but then they become a kind of, can become sterile, and therefore it's always the renewal, like in fairy tales, the renewal of the king and so forth. But originally the king is also somebody who brings light, and as the king was the son, the son of God, and so Themis and Nemesis, they are goddesses of the of a feeling, if I would say a feeling of how things have to be. And if you don't listen to that, or if you get over the boundary, then shame is arising. Yeah, Themis is very important in that, yes?
Would that be more on the civil end of things rather than the personal thing?
Both. But more on the civil, of course. I mean, more on this, on the social end, yeah. Yes.
Something just crossed my mind, that there is not corresponding to what you mentioned, that describes usually that there are certain boundaries behind these rules that you take on form of the mind and the
Yes, very yes. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yes, it's very true. And I thought I was very much in two minds, for instance, about the whole thing with Saddam Hussein and the Arabs and so forth, because if they get humiliated, the revenge feelings are even much, much worse. Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, then the revenge feelings are much more. And it was interesting that for instance, Sadat at the time, he could make peace with Israel once he had, after the humiliation, he could cross over the Suez Canal and sort of felt now he's stronger, now he can make peace with him. But on the other hand, with someone like Saddam Hussein, he doesn't seem to know shame. No, he's a sociopath. I mean, somebody like this is a sociopath. I mean, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. 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 Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. That's very important. I'm very glad that this question come up. What does it mean having no shame? And if we talk of sociopath or psychopath and so forth, having no shame, and that would mean, let's say, usually, of course, those children are already in a surrounding where they are already neglected and so forth. It's usually already this surrounding. But if you imagine, it does not come to the point where the thou, the other, will be, is possible for the child.
Number 27, 1991. The last in the series of the Swiss Connection, a special series of lectures and workshops by noted Jungian analysts from Zurich. Tonight we have Mario Jacobi, and his speech is The Fig Leaves of Adam and Eve, The Meaning of Shame.
So can you hear me? It seems also in the back. I hope this Swiss connection or Swiss invasion or whatever that is, or Swiss festivities, they call it in Vancouver, is you get used at least to a Swiss accent, I think, no? So tonight we shall discuss and talk about feelings of shame, which is something, of course, very delicate, but it's something we all have, we all share, feelings of guilt, feelings of shame, as well as fear and anxiety, and they are so common to all of us. And in other words, they are archetypal. They are archetypal psychic phenomena. And what matters is how they affect us, of course, personally, and how we personally respond to them. But I think the first question is, can we make a firm distinction between shame and guilt feelings? Because very often it gets mixed up. Sometimes we don't quite know, is it now shame, or is it guilt, or is it both? Because very often we experience a mixture of the two rather than one or the other, so that the distinction is not so easy to make. Somebody, when I was just being on the men's room, someone was there and he said, yeah, isn't it, he gave a very good definition, maybe a better one than I have, isn't it the difference between guilt and shame, that guilt means you have a problem, I have a problem, and shame is I am the problem. I think there is something about this. We could say the following: guilt feelings mean that I experience myself as a bad person because I've done something, or I've fantasized something, or I've failed to do something which is considered bad and usually involves another person or my image of that person. Guilt has usually to do with another person or overstepping a certain norm, but mainly connection with other person I've injured, I've wounded, and so forth. That image will present itself to me of the other. The message of my guilt feelings sent to me is that I am or remain somewhat guilty towards something I should have done, towards a should. And this should, whose fulfillment would be regarded as good. Now, shame means it's something much more archaic than something my whole person. My whole person is exposed to feelings of humiliation. For instance, I make or have made myself ridiculous and must therefore despise myself or be despised by others and devalued as a person. Usually has to do with humiliation, devaluation. And therefore, it's a self-image, the image of myself, which stands in the center, and usually there is a kind of a gulf which stretches between my humiliated ego and the ideal, how I would like to appear and be seen by others and also by myself. I feel then naked and disgraced. And if you have some guilt, usually there is somewhere the feeling you want to make something good, you want to repair. But a person who has been shamed feels demeaned, belittled, and the reaction is that you want to become invisible. You want to sink into the ground because there's nothing you can repair. And that is, therefore, the whole person is so much more involved. I am a problem. The definitions of guilt feelings and shame overlap, of course, at many points. A person who saddles himself with guilt may at the same time feel thoroughly disgraced and dishonored through wrongdoing. Shame, on the other hand, is not limited to what I have done or to what I have neglected to do. I may feel ashamed because I have red hair, because I'm too short, or I'm excessively overweight. I may feel ashamed because my partner says silly things, and I'm not responsible to what my partner says, but still I feel ashamed because he seems to belong to the image of myself. You may feel ashamed about the mother who is so stupid or so fat or whatever, you know. Just belonging to a particular race or family can also constitute the basis for contempt and devaluation. The feeling of guilt, however, generally refers to my conduct with respect to ethical norms as well as towards other people. My conduct also may give rise to shame, but it does not have to. I may feel ashamed also on account of awkwardness or ugliness and so forth. There are many things you may feel ashamed of and you cannot help. It's not your own responsibility. And there's also the experience of fear, the experience of anxiety, which is very often mixed with shame. And my latest book I wrote about shame, but I the title means shame fears or shame anxiety, because that is a shame side we encounter most often in our everyday life, because it means I have great fears, I'm anxious to get into a shameful situation. That is usually what we are most ashamed about, or we fear It's more a kind of a fear to expose ourselves. Shame itself takes hold of me in a particular humiliating situation and then won't let me go. For a long time, and that is also important, when I have fallen into a shame situation, and when I remember the shameful event, I may wake up at night and so forth, remember it, and still there is blushing, and it's still terrible to remember this event. What fool did I make of myself, or what that was? It eats away at one's self-esteem. So we have to distinguish, I think, between this kind of shame, what the French say, talk about, honte, and bashfulness or timidity, namely the fear of getting into a shameful situation. Bashfulness or timidity, on the other hand, is a tendency to react with shame on the smallest occasion. So that events or situations in which agonizing shame could arise are then avoided as far as possible. And these avoidance impulses are manifested in the form of fear much more than of shame. One is afraid of getting into humiliating situations. So it is better, for example, not to speak one's opinion, because otherwise one risks the danger of disgracing oneself by making stupid remarks. One is afraid of exposing oneself, of being in any way conspicuous, of seizing the initiative, for the danger of getting wounded, of having to suffer a blow to one's self-esteem, that is always somewhere lurking. There's always a risk, whatever we speak out when we expose ourselves and so forth, always a risk of being rejected. But then on top of it, the secondary perception that one appears to be bashful and timid further threatens one's sense of self-esteem, creating a vicious circle. Fear of being shamefully exposed makes one timid. And because one is seen as being so timid, one feels inferior. And again, is afraid of being exposed in one's timidity. Then it's a kind of vicious circle. And Jungians have a good recipe, they call it introversion. And then it's not shameful and not embarrassing, it's just introversion, and then it gets valued. And the more timid you are, the more introverted, the more deep. And that is a very good revaluation of values in the Jungian world. But for the moment, I prefer not to go into the neurotic twists of these archetypal human factors, because neither shame nor guilt feelings in themselves are neurotic, of course, because they have their own significance both for the individual and for society. And the significance becomes evident as soon as we call to mind the damage that unscrupulous or shameless and unrestrained people can cause. Shame and guilt are archetypal phenomena, and no civilization could live without that. We have that in ourselves. And they play already a very decisive role in mythology. We always, as soon as we talk about archetypal phenomena, it's also a Jungian tick, then we look, is there a myth or something like that? As if it would not be enough that we experience it as in general. We also look for a myth, and that is something still very interesting to look for. And of course the myth, which still has a great impact on us, is really the myth of Paradise Lost, Garden Eden, as told by the Yahwist in the context of the creation account in the Genesis. And it dates 10th to 9th century before Christ. And the story of the Garden of Eden deals with both guilt and shame. And church tradition, as you know, identifies so-called original sin with the original violation of God's first prohibition. The guilt in the story is caused by the act of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil against the will of God. Before the occurrence of this disobedient transgression, it is said of the man and his wife that they both were naked and were not ashamed. But after enjoying the fruit of the tree of knowledge, their eyes were opened and they saw that they were naked. And then they stitched fig leaves together and made for themselves loincloth. Then when God was strolling in the garden in the cool of the evening, they hid themselves so that he had to call Adam, "Where are you?" Adam had hidden himself because he became aware of his nakedness. Aware. In the Bible, the passage reads, "I was afraid because I'm naked and I hid myself." And here you can see that psychology is really something invented by God. He was a wonderful psychologist because his reply was, God said, "Who told you that you are naked?" By becoming conscious of his nakedness, Adam gave himself away. He gave himself away and showed that eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so the paradisal unitary reality, this primal unity of everything, was forfeited. Now in this story, shame clearly arises through the fact that after Adam and Eve had enjoyed the fruit of knowledge, their eyes were opened. And they saw, they became aware that they were naked. Before this, they also had been naked but were not ashamed. Shame, therefore, seems to have something to do with becoming aware, with becoming conscious. Apparently, their feelings of shame were so unbearable then that the man and his wife felt obliged to stitch fig leaves together in order to cover themselves. But the question remains as to why the first human beings were ashamed in front of one another and even in front of God when they became aware of their natural nakedness. 1,000 years before Christ, it already seems self-evident that nakedness evoked shame. Thus, shame is associated primarily with bodily nakedness and especially with the sex organs. Indeed, the genitals are designated in many languages, so in German, in Greek, and so forth, as shame parts, Schamteile. It's called here the intimate parts, but it's interesting that those parts have to do with shame. And when we ponder this question, it would appear that for human beings, shame is archetypally connected with showing their genitals or letting their genitals be seen, and it seems as if such shame is the hallmark, the primal symptom, so to speak, indicating that humans have fallen out of nature and no longer relate naturally to what is natural. It says, of course, falling out of paradise, falling out of nature. By virtue of this symptom, namely to be conscious, not being able to be one with nature anymore, God perceives that they have eaten from the tree of knowledge. Is it then paradoxically natural to human nature in particular to hide the genitals behind a loincloth, whatever form that loincloth may take? Does this shame coincide with the essence of being human as opposed to being animal? Is it perhaps even inborn in us humans? And here the biologist and ethologist Joachim Illies, a German, he writes that the fig leaf in the form of the loincloth or other covering artifact is found among almost all peoples, including the most so-called primitive. Behind this act of covering, he sees the impetus of shame. Modern child psychology, he adds, can demonstrate that the impulse to hide one's nakedness occurs as a normal developmental step in young people as soon as the sex roles are consciously grasped. Through training, of course, he adds, and he's right, this shame reaction can also be repressed. But anyhow, nakedness then, in his view, has little in common with natural innocence once our level of consciousness has surpassed that of a 5-year-old. In his view, lack of embarrassment at the sight of nudity in an adult of the opposite sex does not indicate that our sexual drive structures have been liberated according to nature, but rather that they have been neutralized or repressed. Thus, the question remains as to whether it is an essential characteristic of human beings to be ashamed of their own nature. If I say it may be archetypal, it probably is, that does not mean we are compelled to feel ashamed, because archetypal, or we have always a certain freedom to relate to the archetype, and of course not everybody has the same amount and intensity of shame and so forth, but it strikes one that is from very early on there is shame, and this particular animals do not seem to feel ashamed of their nature, of their sex and so forth. Is then the feeling of shame towards exposure of the sex organs and shame regarding sexuality, is that archetypally inherent in human nature, or is it rather determined by social convention? Now, if we look back over cultural history, we are struck by the fact that in every era, a special meaning was always ascribed to nudity, to sex organs, to sexuality in general. We are never seen just as purely natural, as just so story, a natural just so story. I want to go just quickly into some quite interesting so-called amplification. You know, amplification, what Jungians do, what Jung began to do when a certain theme, a certain symbol, and then to see, is it archetypal, then to look in the history of symbols and so forth and in different cultures and to see how that was experienced and what people have thinking and have been writing about it and so forth. How was the superstition in connection to this and so forth. So nakedness and exposure of the genitals are usually considered degrading and humiliating. And such humiliation was often imposed as a punishment for violation of the marriage bond. In Babylonia and in Egypt, the enemy was represented in a denuded state on monuments of all kinds. But voluntary exposure was also important, and mainly in cultic contexts. And that can be viewed as a sign of humility towards the Godhead. We had that in the Crusades, but later on, when it was total nudity, was later replaced by bare feet and unbound hair. It is believed that the Indian god Shiva wishes his worshippers to dance in the nude. By contrast, among the ancient Hebrews, it was a dreadful crime to expose one's nakedness before God. And therefore, today still, you go in a synagogue, you need a hat on. You cannot go even to show your bare face and your bare head. And the Christian God, especially the God of Roman Catholics, does not look kindly on tourists visiting his churches with indecently dressed, that means with short, not having sleeves and so forth, as if God would not know how he created his humankind. He should not see what he did, it seems. In ancient dream books, too, nakedness in dreams is interpreted as threatening. It can even signify death. A passage from a Hindu dream book reads, "If someone dreams that he is suddenly exposed and his nakedness is seen by everyone, then his secret will be revealed and he himself will be reviled and tormented." In any case, the association of shame with nakedness is very widespread. And of course, we can also see, we know that there are many archaic people who did not have loincloth and they really lived in a naked state. But even there, it is considered to be highly improper to direct one's gaze toward the naked genitals of the other. Shame is there whether you are naked or not. And you go to the sauna and you always feel the shame. You go to nudist beach and somewhere the shame always lurks around whether you are. It never is completely natural. Similarly, in ancient Greece, where we are, you know, where these famous athletes, these wonderful boys, these bodies, we have the statues of them, and in the gymnasium is really what means really nude school, comes from gymnos, naked, and they really trained naked, and the Olympia, it was all in nude, but women were not allowed to look, women were not accepted to go and watch this. Only after 60, I think, they after a certain age, we are allowed to go. The display of nudity, generally regarded as constituting also offensive conduct against civilization, of course, is often a factor in protest action. Even Upright Zurich, more than a decade ago, you may remember, saw naked youth marching in protest demonstrations down prestigious and proper Bahnhofstrasse. And there were so many, the police couldn't do anything about it. But let us return to the Garden of Eden. As soon as consciousness is born, when Adam and Eve eat from the tree of knowledge, shame, which until then did not exist, enters the picture. They became aware that they were naked. In other words, what has happened? I become aware of my own body image and of the body image of the other, what so far was not. They were unconscious of that, but there is a kind of a separation of her body image, my body image, together with our respective boundaries. The differentiation of opposites in good and bad occurs not only there, but also between I and you, I and thou. Adam and Eve are no longer one. Instead, there is his naked body and hers. The need of both then to hide their nakedness leads to mutual self-definition. And that's the beginning of individualization. I'm me, and she's her. I'm in my naked body, and I'm seen by thou. That is something very important. I because without that shame cannot arise, without the knowledge or awareness, I could be seen by others, and babies don't have that knowledge yet. So I wish to cover my nakedness. So it's the first distinction, I, thou, ego, self, end of unitary reality. And then they do something about it, first people. Whatever we may think of the proverbial fig leaf, we cannot fail to see, of course, how much hypocrisy has been sheltered by it. And yet, if I may stay with the symbolism of the paradise myth, isn't it the first creative human act which is really linked with the fig leaf? For the text reads, they stitched fig leaves together and made for themselves loincloth. Shame occasioned by the discovery of their shameful nakedness appears to have motivated them to find a remedy. And that is fallen out of nature. And see, I can change something, if I can transform something. They did not just take the fig leaves, they also, stitched them together. They made a remedy. They did not surrender helplessly to their shame. Thus, the dawning of consciousness brings with it shame towards one's personal nakedness, and shame in turn becomes the motivation for the removal of this nakedness by some creative act. Shame in the wake of dawning consciousness seems, therefore, to be a driving force behind our cultural development. I remember, for instance, I'm sure you have, shame can lead to some, maybe kind of a creative motivation. I remember that I was a violinist and musician. At one time, I remember we studied in the class with a master, and there were at least 7 or 8 violinists, and you had to play there. And sometimes you really made a fool of yourself in front of the whole class because it didn't quite sound as it should, and so forth. And it was terrible. Would like to sink into the ground. And now either you were so blocked that you never wanted to go back there, or it really forced you to really study and train and so forth, not to fall into that terrible, shameful abyss again. I think shame can somehow stimulate in that sense, to stitch yourself a loincloth that you are better equipped. If you have to expose yourself. Now, notwithstanding all the psychic pain and neurotic phenomena that are connected with feelings of shame, shame as such, I think, has a meaning for our psychic economy. Therefore, one could say, what does it? It throws us back on ourselves. To use the expression of Heidegger, we mark ourselves off and begin to hide parts of ourselves from others to keep some things to ourselves. What happens in myself, in my fantasies, my thoughts, my innermost being, is nobody else's business. And shame, as it were, protects this inner space and ideally mediates a feeling for what I'm willing to reveal and share, what I prefer to keep to myself. In other words, each person has a shame threshold, which can be higher or lower and more or less differentiated. Now, of course, one can say from a global perspective, to be sure, all persons are equal in their archetypal endowment. Physically, we are all equal. We have all these genitals are not such a mystery. We all know how genitals look like. Or all feelings and everything what we experience are human, are typically human. There's nothing which is not archetypal, which is not collective. I think the most personal thing, therefore the personal unconscious or the most personal thing, is a very, very specific form of archetypal happening because it's human. And we could say, why do we have to hide something as human? We all know, and yet, at the same time, though, each person's individuality harbors somewhere a secret, which is protected preeminently by means of shame. Therefore, there is a shame and there is embarrassment, although in the other person, if you reveal things which don't seem ready to be revealed, then you may feel ashamed later, and the other person has to hear it or see it as well, feels embarrassed. So there is this, I come to this between nearness and distance and so forth, there is some this shame threshold plays a great role. Thus, a loincloth made of fig leaves has also to be regarded as a prototype, I would say, of what Jung rightly called the persona. Because bodily coverings and clothing in dreams are usually interpreted as symbols of the persona. And here I would like to say a few words about the persona, the Latin word for mask, which may be a familiar concept to many of you, but even so it is useful to review such concepts from time to time. Now the mask plays a great part in the theater of ancient Greece, where the actors had to wear a mask. But that is interesting. Greek tragedies were always based on a dramatized myth, never on the entanglements of middle-class individuals leading ordinary lives, like our plays. We are all acquainted with such tragic protagonists as Electra, Iphigenia, Antigone, King Oedipus, and so forth. So the actors represented not ordinary people, but mythical figures. The human individuality of the actor had to disappear behind the mask and behind the collective idea represented by the mythical figure. The mask accentuated, in other words, the transpersonal, the suprapersonal, while veiling the personal and individual. In this way, the actor grew up to the mythical figure whom he was expected to portray. Now, in the theater of our everyday life, we too must wear a mask, which may or may not correspond to our individual frame of mind, but is nevertheless expected by the collective. For instance, when you go to a funeral, you must put on a mask of mourning, even if your joy over the inheritance you anticipate is stronger and more genuine than your sorrow. When you go to a party, you must put on a festive mask, even if you are in a terrible mood and don't feel at all like being in with those people who, but otherwise you make yourself unpopular. Thus, adaptation to collective expectations usually requires us to wear a certain mask for us and also concern for the other, because if we all carry our moods with us around, it's also terrible for the other people. So how I must behave, how I should dress, what my social status demands of me, these are all questions that involve the so-called persona. We can then define the persona as a fig leaf meant to hide our essential naked truth, our most intimate core. This means that we cannot speak really about shame without referring to the psychology of the persona. And one of its collective functions of this persona is precisely named to protect individuals from getting into embarrassing situations, into feelings of shame. When someone loses his or her persona, this often amounts to what we say a loss of face. For example, an individual may be pulled into inadequate affect and as a result divulge too much of his or her innermost self, which in turn arouses feelings of shame and afterwards, how disgracefully I behaved, and you still feel ashamed for quite some time. It's a kind of a typical articulation of such feelings. So consequently, Jung views the persona as a compromise between individual and society. And I think that there are three components to the persona. There is first the ego ideal, the way I would like to be seen, the way I would like to be. There's secondly the expectations coming from the environment to which you have to adapt to a certain extent. And very important, the third is a certain awareness of the psychic and physical conditions that constitute the personality and set limits to the ego ideal as well as to adaptation, namely our nature behind the loincloth. The loincloth somehow has to suit our nature. The first factor, ego ideal, is my visual image of myself on when the attitude of the persona is involved. There may also be the wish to demonstrate this ideal image of myself to the environment. My demonstration may be obtrusive or subtle. For the most part, it belongs to the so-called narcissistic sphere. The attending danger is always to mistake the mask for one's own face. If in such a case, tendencies and aspects of my personality that do not conform to my ideal self-image become visible, whether to others or just only to myself, shame reactions naturally arise. In other words, I feel ashamed then of my so-called shadow parts because I don't want to see myself. The second component has to do with the expectations of the environment, meaning that I have to develop a certain sense, a certain feeling for the roles assigned to me and the expectations to which I should adapt. And here the difficulty arises. That is often by no means a matter of course to distinguish between the expectations of the real outer world and our fantasies about those expectations. Because we experience expectations from the figures of our childhood that we have unconsciously internalized. We may project them again on the expectations of our present environment. If so, then a discrepancy develops between our own ideas about what is expected and the actual expectations of the environment. Problems of this kind are encountered, for instance, by people who rise from a lower to a higher social class or who move from the country into the city. And then there's a feeling of uncertainty regarding the expectations of the new environment and the painful fear that one will misbehave, which will be very embarrassing. Embarrassment is, of course, a kind of shame. It belongs to the shame family. Generally, we can observe of what is commonly called inhibition, that then there's a high inner expectations which hamper spontaneity. There are fantasies of expectations which hamper the spontaneity. Therefore, one is inhibited, cannot just be spontaneous. And very often they do not correspond at all to the real expectations which we are faced with. Such discrepancies are discernible in the analytic situation through the transference. There you can make, very often people become aware and they can express more what they expect me, the analyst, and so forth, what the analyst is expecting from them. And they usually, those fantasies have to do with what they feel the others are expecting. And very often, it's very far off from what I really expect. And then you can catch it and see it. Where do those fantasies come from? What is expected from me, which has so little to do with the reality. And this brings, of course, to the decisive importance of the third factor, namely our psychic and physical givens, our naked nature behind the fig leaf. In other words, it is a matter of our consciousness, our sense of ourselves, our identity, our intrinsic being as we are. And this essence should not receive too short shrift, even our most superficial social context, otherwise we are no more than mask-like and react with the so-called false self, what Winnicott called false self and persona is a great similarity. Or we are determined by others and live only with reference to what others expect of us. We live fantasies of others, and that very, very often happens if our parents had very strong fantasies, what they wanted us, the kind of extensions of themselves, how they wanted us to be. We either live those expectations unconsciously and always project them to our surrounding, or we are in constant rebellion against it. Persona involves, in any case, the question, what do others think of me? That is the main question of the persona. In what light am I seen? Do other people take me seriously and respect me as a person? Do I fall too far outside the norm? And if so, do people marvel at me for being way above average, or do I seem ridiculously out of place? When a woman wears an outré dress, for example, if it suits her particularly well, it may bring her admiration and emulation. It even may create a new fashion because many other women will imitate it and so forth. But if it is noticeably peculiar and does not seem natural to her, it can also elicit the deprecating whispers. Shame thus induces us to keep our own intimate emotional life to ourselves when it is of no concern to those around us, if we feel it's no concern. It thus encourages a sense of boundaries and a feeling for our own identity. An extreme proneness to shame, however, results in disturbed relationships and social isolation. So, on one hand, shame has this function of really keeping things to ourselves a certain way, what we rather have to hide, only to reveal to the analyst. But at the same time, there's a contrast, because shame exerts at the same time a strong pressure to adapt, because it comes into play when we make a bad impression and so expect to be devalued by others. In short, shame promotes both individualization on one hand and social adaptation simultaneously. And there the question is whether this inconsistency does not necessarily lead to conflicts within the individual. And such conflicts may arise when the two functions of shame, which are fundamentally dissimilar or even opposite. Hundred years before